Nuclear Resurrection. 46 years ago, on March 28, 1979, the accident at the Unit 2 nuclear reactor at Three Mile Island in Pennsylvania, near Harrisburg, resulted in a meltdown of fuel rods, a release of radiation into the air that contaminated the local community, and enough public opposition to nuclear that the industry's new builds virtually ground to a halt. TMI-2 never started again, and while TMI-1 returned to service and continued, it was finally shut down in September 2019. But now, after 5.5 years in mothballs, plant owner Constellation, formerly known as Exelon, is planning to restart this 1974 model nuclear reactor to provide electricity that will be sold exclusively to Bill Gates to support a Microsoft data center. Besides major business questions about using a facility built with public funds to exclusively fuel a private for-profit enterprise, there's the question of safety for a nuclear reactor designed in the 1960s that started operating in 1974, 51 years ago. It takes a veteran activist drawing a parallel equivalency in automotive terms to make the point of how wrong-headed this is. And when he tells us,
"This plant started in 74, the same year as the Ford Pinto came out. I don't see the government going around opening Ford Pinto plants. And you know, TMI and the Ford Pinto have a shared history." Nobody could answer, "We're going to get the parts." 1974. And really, is this what we want to spend our money on? $2 billion on an Edsel.
An Edsel, for those of you too young to remember, was a failed and discredited Ford car that was used for years as the punchline of many jokes. Well, when Eric Epstein of Three Mile Island Alert, a man who has racked up more years and miles protesting against TMI than probably anyone else, puts it in such clear consumer-oriented terms, you see how this nuclear relic is one more outpost of that dangerous, deadly, awful seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. We're a show for people who know nothing about nuclear who want to know something, and people who know something about nuclear who would like to know just a little bit more. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we acknowledge the anniversary of the 1979 accident at the Three Mile Island Nuclear Power Station by getting an update on why TMI is once again in the news, and not in a good way. We talk with Eric Epstein, chairman of Three Mile Island Alert, a safe energy organization based in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and he gives us the latest. We will also have nuclear news from around the world. Linda Pence Gunter with the Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story, Jack Cohen-Joppa of the Nuke Resistor with another story from our history of successful activist resistance, and more honest nuclear information than just got leaked along with top-secret U.S. war plans on Signal. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, March 25th, 2025, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. We learned in February that Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency, note that he has not been vetted, approved, or empowered by anyone. He's just been given an agency and power to do whatever he likes. DOGE, as it's known,
has been slashing through the federal workforce without much thought for the consequences, and that includes cuts to the National Nuclear Security Administration, or NNSA. In February, DOGE fired more than 300 NNSA staffers, only to send them panicked emails rescinding the layoffs after it realized that what they did was oversee the nuclear stockpile. Spin had the Department of Energy telling news outlets that fewer than 50 people had actually been dismissed, and most of them were clerical and admin types. Yet, according to a new report in the New York Times, the number is much higher and the loss is greater. DOGE cuts began with buyout offers that more than 130 people working on nukes took. The Times also said that 27 people were fired and not rehired. The list included, quote, at least 27 engineers, 13 program or project analysts, 12 program or project managers, 6 budget analysts or accountants, 5 physicists or scientists, as well as attorneys, compliance officers, and technologists. John Carl Baker, deputy director of programs at the Plowshares Fund, told Gizmodo, cutting experts in nuclear security at the very moment when the U.S. is replacing its entire nuclear arsenal is foolish. This ambitious undertaking already has serious risks, and proceeding with fewer qualified specialists makes it more likely that something will go awry. A note to DOGE from Nuclear Hot Seat. You wanna save money? Stop making new nukes. Eliminating nuclear pit production will save us over $60 billion with a B dollars over the next 30 years, and that would be just the start of the savings. And in New York on March 5, 17 people were arrested at the U.S. mission to the United Nations during a protest in support of the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. Participants had asked for a meeting with the interim U.S. ambassador to the UN and were refused. Others blocked First Avenue with a giant banner reading, U.S., join the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. And as it was also Ash Wednesday, some carried signs that said, nuclear war means the world in ashes. For more on the third meeting of states parties of the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, held at the United Nations March 3rd through 7, see last week's episode, number 716, for a full program report. From Pennsylvania comes word that radioactive contamination in freshwater mussels is potentially affecting the food chain in that state. From radioactive material accumulating in not just aquatic life, but up the food chain to land animals, birds, and people. Local fishing activity in the Allegheny River also raises questions about indirect exposure to radioactive material. And we will link to a news release sent out by Kimberly Roberson of Fukushima Fallout Awareness Network, calling on the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, headed by Robert F. Kennedy Jr., to finally address the long-neglected and growing problem of radioactive contamination of U.S. food and water. The group has focused primarily on cesium-134 and 137 levels in food, and back in 2013, sent in a petition asking for a re-examination of the levels allowed that contained nearly 30,000 signatures and 1,600 comments, calling on FDA and other relevant federal offices to slash allowable levels of cancer-causing cesium in the U.S. food supply. We'll link to more information about this. So what does an effective protest against nuclear interests look like? 35 years ago, rural communities in western New York took nonviolent direct action to bump the dump, stopping the state and the nuclear industry from trashing their countryside with quote-unquote low-level nuclear waste. Here's Jack Cohen-Joppa of the Nuclear Resistor Newsletter with the story of the true tale of two counties that stood up and shut the door when the nuclear industry came knocking.
People in western New York were pissed off. In December 1988, the State Low-Level Radioactive Waste Siting Commission announced that 10 sites in rural western counties were the best spots for the state's so-called low-level radioactive waste dump, mandated by federal law. The reaction was fast and fierce. In Cortland County, more than 3,000 people attended the commission's first public info meeting on January 23rd. After what they heard, 1,300 returned the very next day to occupy the county office building, filling the halls with chants of "Bump the Dump." 3 days later, and 100 miles farther west, the same roadshow arrived to explain their plan at Belfast Central High School. There, concerned citizens of Allegheny County were leading a public education campaign that had snowballed, and 5,000 people showed up, a full 10% of that county's population. They overflowed from the gymnasium to other rooms and finally outside, where most heard the raucous meeting through loudspeakers. One after another, residents stood to condemn a selection process skewed against them while decrying the radioactive threat to the health and property values of their farming community. The commissioners, in turn condescending and callous, did nothing to moderate the accelerating reaction. The crowd whooped and hollered when one man summed up their resolve and told the commission, "We will fight this decision every step of the way. We will fight you in the halls of science. We will fight you in the courts of law. We will fight you in the legislature, and if necessary, we will fight you in the streets." And they did. Hundreds of creative and informative projects sprang up. Parades and posters, cooking and cartoons, fine art, theater, quilting, and more. All to raise money, meet allies, and fortify their opposition. Signs and banners adorned businesses, barns, and homes. But the siting commission plowed ahead. Next step, windshield surveys driving to each site. Believing this scenario was ripe for civil disobedience, the Allegheny County Nonviolent Action Group came together and began training dozens of new activists to peacefully block the site surveys. In Cortland County, the Citizens Against Radioactive Dumping did the same. And when commissioners returned to Allegheny County in May, dozens of locals surrounded their car, preventing them from entering the site. The county sheriff reluctantly made 48 arrests. When they were released from custody, courthouse workers cheered and held anti-dump signs from the windows. The people knew there'd be more surveys at each site, so they set up networks of road monitors using citizens' band radio and telephone trees to mobilize blockaders every time the city slicker commissioners rolled in. From December 89 to April 1990, 4 blockades at the Allegheny sites and 2 in Cortland County led to over 140 arrests and prevented agents from surveying any of the 5 sites. Another 21 people had been arrested during 2 weeks of blocking the dump project storefront in Cincinnatus. Cortland County District Attorney allied with the activists there and dropped disorderly conduct charges, telling Governor Cuomo that the actions of the commission were simply ludicrous and inflammatory. The campaign reached its dramatic climax on April 5, 1990, when all 9 possible routes to the Canadeo site were blocked. State police escorting the survey team first had to arrest 6 grandparents for the future, one in a wheelchair, who had handcuffed themselves to a chain blocking the old Genesee River Iron Bridge. Delayed for hours, police then pressed on toward the site 2 miles away. Now many farm implements blocked the road, and troopers had to march through the mud to get by. The last line of resistance was mounted horses, their experienced riders turning the horses' rears toward the advancing cops, who soon sparked a melee, clubbing horses and knocking riders from their mounts while making 31 more arrests. The next day, the governor of New York, who'd been claiming he had no authority over the work of the independent commission, put a halt to the site surveys. Later, a grand jury dismissed all charges while recommending more training for state police. Fast forward 2 years, and the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that the federal government may not force state governments to take title to nuclear waste, and the rural sites were removed from consideration. This has been Jack Cohen-Joppa for Nuclear Hot Seat, bringing you another story from the Nuclear Resistor Archives to inspire your activism today.
Over to Japan, where robots will begin moving sandbags that were used to absorb radiation-contaminated water after the 2011 Fukushima nuclear disaster began. Tokyo Electric Power Company, or TEPCO, the operator of the stricken Japanese power plant, says the bags on underground floors of two buildings have been left untouched following the nuclear accident because radiation levels on the sandbag surfaces are as high as 4.4 sieverts per hour, which means basically that humans can die if they approach them. This according to TEPCO spokesman Tatsuya Matoba. Japanese media reports that there were 2,850 bags to be collected and that they weigh 41.5 tons. TEPCO aims to finish removal of these bags by the end of the 2027 fiscal year, which is not only optimistic but ludicrous, given that previous robots used in cleanup have fried before being able to accomplish much. And out of the 880 tons of radioactive material still on site, robots have thus far been able to remove 0.7 grams, 7/10 of a gram. Internationally, during the United Nations third meeting of states parties on the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, one of the most significant events was the annual awarding of the Nuclear Free Future Award on Wednesday, March 5th. There was a special magic in the air as the 2025 laureates were honored in the historic Great Hall at Cooper Union. Here's Linda Pence Gunter with this week's Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story.
My first experience of the Nuclear Free Future Awards, which were founded in 1998, was in 2010 in New York City. The awards were held in the Great Hall at Cooper Union, made famous by Abraham Lincoln's February 27, 1860 speech there, before he became president and before he was even the Republican nominee. That speech, during which Lincoln declared that slavery was wrong, has been credited with winning him the election later that year. Lincoln's lectern still stands on the Cooper Union stage, and at the 2010 Nuclear Free Future Awards, Henry Red Cloud of the Oglala Lakota Nation spoke at it. Henry is a descendant of the renowned Lakota leader and warrior Red Cloud, who also spoke in that same hall on July 16, 1870. Henry, who was honored for his work installing solar power across the Pine Ridge Reservation, wore one of Red Cloud's famous eagle feathers for the occasion. Eerily, that date, July 16, has remained significant for Native Americans in particular. It was when the first atomic bomb was detonated, the Trinity Test, an event that has had lasting health impacts on tribes in New Mexico, not just from fallout, but from the uranium mining industry needed to supply first the military and then the so-called civil nuclear sector. July 16 was also the date of the worst and largest accidental release of radioactive waste in U.S. history, when a uranium tailings dam in Church Rock, New Mexico, ruptured, sending 90 million gallons of liquid radioactive waste and 1,100 tons of solid mill wastes cascading into the Puerco River, an essential water source for the surrounding Navajo population. They, too, still suffer the after-effects of that disaster, which has never been adequately cleaned up. Red Cloud's 1870 address highlighted the detrimental impact of American encroachment on indigenous territories and called attention to the importance of honoring agreements made with native tribes. Those wrongs also remain to be righted. After that first taste of the Nuclear Free Future Awards in 2010, I became more deeply involved, both as a nominator of candidates for the award, including the 2022 winner and your gracious host, Libby Halevi, and also as a jury member. There was magic in the hall that night in 2010, and the same magic returned there earlier this month when the 2025 Nuclear Free Future Awards were again held at Cooper Union. My organisation, Beyond Nuclear, has now become a co-owner of the event, along with our European partner, International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War Germany. So my review here is not entirely unbiased. There will soon be a full article and video of the event available on the Nuclear Free Future Awards website, found at nuclearfreefutureaward.org. There you can already read about this year's laureates and past laureates, and once the video is up, you will hear the profound and moving tributes from the presenters, as well as the laureates in their acceptance speeches. S.P. Udayakumar from India, who received the award for resistance this year, spoke in a video testimonial about the trials and tribulations of taking on the Russian nuclear power plant behemoth being built in his home state of Tamil Nadu. Even though Uday was not able to be there in person, thanks to visa intransigence by the U.S. consulate there, his words were met with long and rapturous applause, and his sons were able to come from Maryland to speak about him. Marcia Gomez and Norbert Suchanek, who created the International Uranium Film Festival in Brazil from very small beginnings, detailed the unlikely odyssey that brought them finally to this worthy moment of recognition for a festival that now travels the world. They received the award in the category of education. And Edwick Matsimura of Zimbabwe, the Solutions Laureate, spoke eloquently about the struggles of women in particular, and African women especially, in the nuclear disarmament world. Two honorary awards also moved the audience greatly. Tributes were paid to the late Navajo activist, musician, author and filmmaker Clee Benally by his mother Berta and by two of his indigenous colleagues, Leona Morgan and Padush Gilbert, who greatly missed their fearless comrade. And living legend Joanna Macy was honoured for her leadership in so many levels of peacemaking. Her words of thanks read by Kathleen Sullivan of the Nuclear Truth Project and her Baksha Stories. We don't yet know when and where the next awards will be, but Nuclear Hot Seat will be sure to keep you posted. I'm Linda Pence-Gunter of Beyond Nuclear, reporting for Nuclear Hot Seat, and that's this week's Hot Story.
We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment, but first, I know you care about getting honest nuclear information, and that's what we set out to provide here at Nuclear Hot Seat every week. Verifiable nuclear news that's been sourced, checked, and footnoted for accuracy, plus interviews with people who are genuine experts on various aspects of the nuclear industry and its impact on life, health, and our shared genetic future. We also tell you stories of brave people on the front lines of anti-nuclear activism around the world, their triumphs and their challenges. We get underneath the manicured surface of mainstream media's nuclear stories to provide context and continuity, because we want you to understand what the issues are, what we are up against, and what any one of us can do about it. But to keep this show going, we need your support. Nuclear Hot Seat cannot survive without it. So if you're grateful for the information you get from the show, now is the time to help us out. If you've ever had even a slight thought that donating to Nuclear Hot Seat was a good idea, but you haven't done it yet, hey, how about starting now? We make it easy for you. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com, click on the red donate button, and follow the prompts. If you have Zelle, you can send money directly to info@nuclearhotseat.com. Nuclear Hot Seat is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which means that anything you donate is tax deductible. So don't wait. Go now to nuclearhotseat.com to donate. And know that whatever you can do to help, you are making a difference to the show and to the world. And that, as always, I am deeply grateful that you are listening and that you care. Now, here's this week's featured interview. At the start of each episode, I mentioned that I was 1 mile from the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island when it happened, an event and experience that changed my life and ultimately led to me doing this show for all these years. I did not live in the area. I was visiting an old friend who had just moved there a few months before. They say that timing is everything, and mine was, let's just say, notable. I write about the experience and its aftermath extensively in my book, Yes, I Glow in the Dark, 1 mile from Three Mile Island to Fukushima and Nuclear Hot Seat, and I'll post a link to it on the website under this episode. Know that after the accident, Unit 2 reactor never operated again, and Unit 1 was shut down in 2019 for what was labeled economic reasons. But now there is a push to restart the mothballed Unit 1 to provide power exclusively to Bill Gates and Microsoft for a data center. How has this happened? What does it mean? And is there any way to stop it? Questions like that call for another in a long series of interviews I've conducted with Eric Epstein. He is the chairman of Three Mile Island Alert Incorporated at TMIA.com. It's a safe energy organization based in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, that was founded in 1977. TMIA monitors not just Three Mile Island, but also the Peach Bottom and Susquehanna nuclear generating stations. For more than 40 years, Mr. Epstein has specialized in research, litigation, and providing expert testimony on the decommissioning, decontamination, environmental safety or lack thereof, rate recovery, and waste isolation at nuclear reactors. This time, we spoke on Sunday, March 23, 2025. And for those of you who may be unfamiliar with the acronym NRC that we use, it stands for the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Eric Epstein, as always, welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat. Give us, first of all, for those people who may not be familiar, just a little bit of background on Three Mile Island and its two reactors.
Yeah, so it's a pretty convoluted and complex history, but Three Mile Island used to be operated by the Longneckers. It was a watermelon farm because it flooded so frequently and the soil was rich. We're also very close to an international airport, about 3 miles from the airport, and it's on the Susquehanna River, which empties into the Chesapeake Bay. So TMI-1, which we're trying to restart, actually began operation in 1974. It was behind schedule and over budget. TMI-2, the same thing, the plant that had the accident, it came online in late December 78 and began melting down on March 28, 79. At the time TMI-2 melted, TMI-1 was shut down for refueling. There was a very intense, difficult, hard-fought battle to keep the plant from not operating. They returned to operation in 85. Meanwhile, TMI-2 didn't have any money to finance decommissioning. So there was a thing called the Thornburg Plan. He was a governor at the time, where mostly taxpayers and ratepayers paid to defuel the plant, which confuses people. And defueling ended in 1993. Defueling was just to move the fuel to Idaho. It was a special arrangement. It was moved on train. 93, the plant is put into post-monitored defueling storage. It means it was mothballed. So TMI-2, mothballed in 93. TMI resumes operation in 85.
Unit 1 is the one that restarted.
Yeah, Unit 1 restarted, I think it was October 4th, 1985, after a protracted legal battle. And then TMI-2 was in the middle of a very intense defueling effort. That fuel put on trains, shipped to Idaho. The condition is not good. Some of the casks have leaked and cracked, but nobody seems to really care. So back at the island, TMI-1 operated until 2019 and was shut down for economic reasons. Had different owners, and is currently owned by Constellation, which used to be Exelon. TMI-2, the same thing, a number of different owners. First Energy sold the TMI-2 plant, and this is happening a lot. People need to really be aware of this. They sold it to a private equity firm. Among the people invested in Three Mile Island are Sarah Lee Cake and TGI Fridays. So people need to be aware, when they say private equity, it doesn't mean that they have any expertise. So TMI-2 sold. The reason, and again, this is what private equity is looking for, the decommissioning funds. They want to raid the decommissioning funds.
Explain where the decommissioning funds come from and how they have been accruing.
When the TMI accident happened, due to the lack of vision of the NRC, there were no decommissioning funds. There was no money put aside. So now most of the money for decommissioning came from ratepayers. You can go to the NRC site and see where they're at. The problem with decommissioning is the NRC only asks you to save to the minimal amount. So every company is just at their minimum based on their projections. The other problem, at least in our mind with decommissioning, is obviously nuclear waste isolation. So at TMI, if you're looking at the history, it's real interesting. TMI-1 has 700 tons of radioactive waste. Their ISFE, their independent spent fuel storage installation, is full. They've got to build another one. That's another 700 tons on an island in a river that floods. TMI2, the other company, is building their own ISFI. It's just bizarre. So there'll be three of these fuel installations. And what's ironic, at TMI2, I asked the NRC, you can't have it both ways. You said you shipped all the fuel out. So how can they create a spent fuel facility on an island where your plant has no fuel? So it is very complex and twisted.
There have recently been some very high-powered and I think very frustrating meetings that have taken place regarding these issues. Tell us about your experience at the most recent two, which I believe were in the last week to 10 days.
So we had three meetings in the last week. They were all awful. I mean, the NRC just is not responding to questions. And when we reached out to TMI1, they had their attorney email me. So it's like you're back in 1978, just the arrogance and the hubris. The only thing that changed is the clothing. So we had two meetings this week with the NRC. They were both public meetings. One was on engineering, and what we focused on was institutional memory. You know, if you're restarting a plant that's been shut for 5 years, how do you transmit that knowledge? And so I badgered them and I just said, look, we've been asking for this for 40 years. I mean, every plant is unique. Every plant has its own individual history, and they refuse to answer. The new thing the NRC is doing at these meetings is if it's not explicitly stated on the agenda, they refuse to answer. So here's the other thing that really shocked me. I asked them, why do you not have minutes or a transcript? And they really couldn't answer. I said, so there's no record. He said, no, we'll give a summary. I said, that's not a record. That's your perception of what happened. So that was last Tuesday. Last Thursday was, again, and in both of these instances, the company gives you a presentation and then the NRC responds. And when the public responds, you're only allowed to respond to the NRC. So in the second meeting, I just got frustrated because they weren't answering questions. And I said, can you ask the company if they'll respond? And, you know, the NRC guy said, well, since they didn't respond, there was no response. And I said, just ask them. You know, it was like an Abbott and Costello bit. One of the things that concerns me is the lack of historic knowledge at the NRC. There are challenges at TMI that should have been obvious to them. I think they crapped the bed on the steam generators when they shut the plant down, same as Palisades. They didn't inject the steam generators with a wet blanket or moisture to keep it from cracking. Palisades is a mess. They probably need generators. But what I try to tell people is, look, this plant started in 74, the same year as the Ford Pinto came out. I don't see the government going around opening Ford Pinto plants. And you know, TMI and the Ford Pinto have a shared history. And nobody could answer. We're going to get the parts. 1974. And really, is this what we want to spend our money on? $2 billion on an Edsel. And what's really awful about the TMI1 experience, everything else included, is that it's going to one customer. We're not benefiting. You're using our water and we're transmitting the electricity. So we haven't gained any more capacity. All we've incurred is more risk. Which is similar, people don't know this. Three Mile Island never really supplied electric to the area around Harrisburg. We were a PPL rate base,
What does that mean?
Pennsylvania Power and Light. TMI was originally owned by three companies, none of them based here: Metropolitan Edison in Allentown, Penelec in Western PA, and Jersey Central Power and Light. So the irony is that, again, the energy is being transmitted off-site and has no benefit to the local community and all the risk. And the other thing is, when nuclear power kind of came into the fore, you probably remember this in the 70s, there was recession, stagflation, and this was going to be the answer. You know, so you're rushing TMI online because nuclear is going to be the answer. Again, they wouldn't answer my question, but all these plants are getting their fuel from Russia, uranium. So we switched our addiction from an Arab oil embargo to a uranium deal. There's no discussion about any of this. I mean, it's such a pro-nuclear zeitgeist. It's a very strange experience. The younger people are very pro-TMI. The people here during the accident obviously oppose it. And I would be honest, it's going to be tough to prevail in any legal jurisdiction, but Both plants right now, it's bizarre. One is being actively decommissioned and then one is being poised to restart.
The reason given for the restart or the hoped for restart of TMI-1 after more than 5 years on the blocks, if you could use a car term with it, is that they have created this unholy alliance with Bill Gates and Microsoft. Talk about what that is.
So TMI couldn't compete. They lost over 5 years, $300 million. So when we did deregulation in Pennsylvania, I was one of the negotiators. And I said, you guys, this is it, right? You're not coming back because they can be pigs. They just have taxpayers, ratepayers pay for their losses. So they shut down, couldn't compete. And there was an artificial crisis created here. Pennsylvania is the second largest exporter, producer of gas. And we have the second largest concentration of nuclear. We export 30% of our energy. And so this is a reaction to the data centers, which is interesting because if Bill Gates is so fond of nuclear, why doesn't he use his nuclear power plant, Terra? It's almost like an advertisement that it's not going to work. So I don't know how this turns out. The PUC has no longer as oversight. It's a merchant generator, and the electric all goes to, I think, three, maybe four data centers, which need energy 24/7, water 24/7. My concern is if there becomes a time when we don't really have enough energy. Right now, PJM, which is our grid, Pennsylvania, Jersey, Maryland, we have surplus. But it's very chaotic and very disturbing, and everybody, just like they did at Three Mile Island the first time, is placing their blind faith in the high priest of nuclear technology. I mean, some of the proposals you see are just like, wow. Holtec, who's restarting Palisades, has never operated a nuclear plant. TMI, most of TMI staff are new. So you got newbies coming in.
And there's no institutional knowledge to be passed down, and every plant is different. It's got its own quirks.
Constellation doesn't understand that. They have a Mid-Atlantic fleet, as I mentioned before, which they rotate for defueling, but they're going to have to cannibalize other plants in order to get staff.
So there's no Pep Boys to go to get the spare parts for this thing.
Right.
I'm quoting you on that one. Don't have the parts. It is technology that went online in, 1974?
Yeah, but it was conceived in the 60s.
That's what I'm getting at. I'm sure that they still use floppy disks that are floppy.
Look, if you remember, at the time of the accident, they had one phone in the control room. So they're actually going to keep the plant as is. No institutional knowledge, no experience, people not familiar with the plant. You're running it for a profit. Same thing as TMI. If you remember, you know, the company was complaining that they were losing money during the accident. We don't learn from history. We always repeat the mistakes. And in Pennsylvania, we never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity.
So who's in charge here? Is it Constellation? Is it the NRC? Is it Microsoft? Who's pushing the buttons?
So that's a really good question, because a lot of the buttons are being pushed remotely. You know, the NRC is down in Maryland, Constellation's based in Baltimore. TMI-2, on the other hand, they're based in Utah. They hire consultants, mostly from New England. So the people in charge aren't really familiar with the community to begin with. The NRC is probably the top dog in a flea-bitten snow sled. I mean, it's just awful. I mean, there's not even a pretense of objectivity. So we will have to litigate at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, steam generator issue, emergency preparedness issue, and other technical issues. DEP, which is the State Department of Environmental Protection, we will be litigating the Clean Water Act, and we will be litigating the NPDES permit. And then I think the big showdown is at the Susquehanna River Basin Commission. Last year, it was interesting, out of nowhere, the Nuclear Energy Institute filed a brief opposing a new policy we had, which is dry cooling. So rather than take water from the plant, you can dry cool a plant. The fracking guys are doing it. And so now we're going to insist on the nuclear guys. I think that's going to be bruising.
There's also an issue about an environmental review that's mandated by the Government Accountability Office, What is their assessment of the environmental review conducted by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission?
If you remember in the beginning of our conversation, we talked about an exemption. What we presume is that they're going to claim they have an exemption from doing an environmental impact statement. And what they're preparing to do is an environmental study. What we learned from Peach Bottom, which has been litigated by Diane Curran and Beyond Nuclear, Peach Bottom was ordered when they got their license to do another study. Rather than do a study of the plant, they did a generic study. So I'm pessimistic that they're going to have to actually do a renewed environmental impact statement, which goes back to everything we've been talking about before. When you look at the regs, they're grandfathered back to the 70s, prior to when we had stricter environmental regulations. Peach Bottom did the same thing. Peach Bottom came online 74. So they're going to want to sidestep that, and we will look at the Clean Water Act and some other permitting.
How intimidating is it for you? And certainly I know Paul Gunter of Beyond Nuclear has been involved with this, as well as some of the other groups. How intimidating is it that not only are you up against Constellation and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, but Bill Gates and Microsoft and their gazillion dollars?
It's not intimidating at all. I mean, we're also up against Talon Energy and Amazon up north. And, you know, it's a history in Pennsylvania. Going back to the coal barons, coming to town and rolling people. So I don't think they're as smart, as tough, as resilient as we are. You know, they're renting their people. We're real people here. So let's have at it. Look, coal is instructive for nuclear. There's 5,000 miles of waterways in Pennsylvania despoiled because of coal permanently. Throughout the state, there's all kinds of abandoned mines and just a lot of ugliness. I don't know if you remember, but we still have the fire burning in Centralia that started in the 60s. We actually have 5 coal mine fires. So of all places, TMI in Pennsylvania should be sensitive of what happens when they stop generating juice. And what happens is they leave. I don't care if it's Amazon. I don't care if it's Bill Gates. They're not going to be around here when there's no energy being generated and the waste has to be cleaned up. So Bill Gates wants to trash that bad, but the energy, I just say, come out here and take out the trash. I mean, this is a very convoluted endeavor. All 3 plants, if you look at Arnold, Palisades, TMI, they were all came online in 74, ironically. They're not that big. So it's ironic. It looks like the government's going to spend about $2 billion, if not more, on 3 nuclear power plants. Duane Arnold in Iowa. It's a small plant, as is Palisades, as is TMI. So the irony is you could be spending up to $6 billion to restart what are essentially fossils. And what TMI is going to do, they're not only moving to restart the plant, simultaneously they're going to ask for a license extension. So I feel rather confident in saying in March 28th, 2079, TMI will not be cleaned up. And what I tell people is this is not a Hollywood movie. There is no good ending. There is no hero. You know, the Faustian bargain with nuclear, you get electricity for a minute, radioactive waste forever. I think it's really difficult for people to grasp that concept. And give the industry credit. They've greenwashed themselves into being clean, which is bizarre. And what I point out is they're cleaner than coal. Okay, that's not really a big deal. But this is a gambit. There's an avoidance cost. And essentially, rather than invest in other technologies, we're resuscitating a zombie nuke.
And the question becomes, how many solar panels and solar systems could be put together for that same amount of money?
A lot more. So what the industry is saying, yeah, but they take up land, as if they really care. So I think up north in Clearfield County, there's a 650 megawatt plant. And to give you some idea, that's almost 80% of Three Mile Island. We have a solar endeavor going in Clearfield County on 5,000 acres. And we have some other really neat stuff in Pennsylvania. You know, we're looking to reclaim old coal sites. I was part of a coalition that brought a wind farm to Bear Creek. So what happens, this crowds out all the money when the government puts their thumb on the nuclear scale. It is 43 years for me, and it's been more for you because you were here during the accident. And the number of people that have an immediate frame of reference is decreasing.
In terms of climate change, how does that impact the safety of the island in the middle of the Susquehanna River with all of this radioactive waste and the hulk of one decommissioned or out of commission reactor and this new one that they're talking about putting back into commission?
Sure. So a nuclear power doesn't do anything to eliminate global warming. Every time you see a nuclear advertisement, they're telling you how much coal that isn't being burnt, which is interesting and ironic. Coal really isn't being built, but coal plants in Pennsylvania are getting extended lives to feed data centers. So in terms of climate change, nuclear indirectly by causing scarcity in energy has allowed coal to continue to operate. So Paul Gunter, who's with Beyond Nuclear, pointed out in our meeting last Thursday that the Government Accountability Office was critical of the NRC for not considering climate change impacts on the operation of nuclear power. It's really severe here. We had a major flood in 72, a major flood in 77. Right now, the behavior of the river is more radically prone to destructive flooding. Also, we have a problem with ice massing. In addition to that, they're not going to say it's true, but I think I can prove it. If there's a drought, and remember Lancaster County, Amish Mennonite right next to us, Lancaster is the most fertile and the most productive non-irrigated county in the country. So you're going to be eating their food. And I don't know why people don't talk about this a lot, but the agricultural impact could be devastating.
What's with the proposed name change? I mean, they're trying to get it changed, or maybe they have already changed 3 Mile Island to Crane Clean Energy Center. What's wrong with this picture?
It's an attempt to rewrite history. It's wrong on a number of fronts. We refer to it as cultural vandalism. We're not going around renaming Pearl Harbor. We're not calling the Titanic the Love Boat. You can't run away from history. And it's thematic now. You see President Trump altering names on military bases. So the name, and everybody knows that the name is powerful. It conjures up an image. And here they are embracing nuclear power, but running away from their past. In addition, Chris Crane, who used to preside over Exelon, one of his subsidiaries, ComEd in Illinois, paid a $200 million fine for bribery. And this is who we're going to name the plant after. While we're at it, why don't we just call TMI-2 the Lee Harvey Oswald generator? I mean, it's so ridiculous, so bizarre. It's a lot of stationary, Libby. And here's the thing. We will never call it the Crane Clean Energy Center. It's 3 Mile Island. It's been 3 Mile Island for a while. So these people coming in from out of state, out of country, want to rename it. They can call it whatever they want. It's 3 Mile Island.
It's an attempt to rebrand it away from
Yes.
its history.
I couldn't have said it better. And it is also symbolic because the industry is going to pound its chest and said, well, you thought nuclear died at 3 Mile Island. It's reborn at TMI. So I think there's huge symbolic meaning to it. But it's a very disturbing, complicated matter at 3 Mile Island because you got two units, two owners, two different sets of priority. One's operate, one's the cleanup. Never been done before. And a whole lot of radioactive waste.
Where do you go from here?
It's a really good question because we have the same problem as the industry. Our people are graying out. At the last TMI alert meeting, it looked like an ARPA reunion. So we're not replenishing our ranks. They're not replenishing their ranks. I just think you have to take it day by day because to take all this in is just incredibly disturbing, especially mentally. The plant was shut down. I didn't realize until recently, this is just an observation. When TMI Unit 2 was being defueled, there was a Japanese contingent at 3 Mile Island. We saw them at all the meetings. They planted cherry trees near the observation center, which would be in bloom today, except Constellation cut them down. And in each cherry center, and I have pictures of it, I'll send it to you, is the Japanese saying we appreciate the friendship and we're here at TMI to make sure something like this doesn't happen in Japan. The plaques are gone. The trees are gone. So when you ask about Chris Crane, this is consistent, you know, with Constellation's behavior. And I don't know that the NRC is going to support us in keeping it at TMI. I actually chastised the NRC and I said, you need to take Christopher Crane off your web. So what they did is they now call it Christopher Crane TMI. But it's a foregone conclusion. So I think what you do is you keep hope, you keep fighting. We'll see what happens. I mean, they're not going to outfight us. They're not going to outlast us. They're going to outspend us, that's for sure. But it's like we say, I'm a football guy. Four quarters in every game, and we'll see who's around at the end of the fourth quarter.
And just to give us a sense of the timeline, when is Constellation, formerly Exelon, again a rebranding, when does Constellation say that they are planning on this restart actually being able to take place?
So they have an aggressive timeline, 2028, but Palisades got waylaid over the steam generator. So we don't know what we don't know yet, but this is how different things are. Governor Shapiro, Democrat, pro-nuclear. Trump and Biden, both pro-nuclear. Our legislature, pro-nuclear. The unions are pro-nuclear. It feels like 1978, we're on the fringes. We're marginalized. You know, after the accident, we were mainstream, as was a lot of environmental groups. So, you know, there's not a uniform position from environmental groups either. I castigated one guy on the call on Thursday. He was from PEC, the Pennsylvania Environmental Coalition. So, you know, what's frustrating is like after TMI, Chernobyl and Fukushima, it's like, dudes, have you not figured out this doesn't work? It's easy to be confident about the restart of TMI when you got $2 billion of other people's money in your back pocket.
Would that you had at least a fraction of that in your back pocket for this effort?
Yeah, you know, I think in retrospect, people are going to go and just view us as environmental Philistines for investing this much money again in a failed technology. Again. We will persist. And again, it's not just Three Mile Island. You know, we're battling up at Susquehanna with Amazon. The FERC has put a temporary stop on the transaction, but it's a stop. And we're still looking at Peach. All three of the plants are different, and they're all in gorgeous parts of the river.
Eric, you have been doing such good work for so long with an incredible level of forbearance, as well as your excellence on this. And I certainly want to thank you for having stood up for me in terms of Three Mile Island, even if it wasn't personal one-on-one. Sure. You were doing it on my behalf as well as everyone else. And I want to thank you for keeping us informed and for being my guest this week on the anniversary of Three Mile Island.
And thanks for being you. Thanks for doing what you do and getting the message out. Because it's pretty lonely here down in the globe mine. Politics is like geology. It's about time and pressure. And I think under the right time, with enough pressure, we can win.
From your mouth to somebody important's ears. That was Eric Epstein, chairman of Three Mile Island Alert. The group email is tmia.com. And to contact Eric Epstein directly, go to epstein@efrankmmary.org. We'll have links up on the website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 717. And while I'm at it, I will also provide a fresh link to my book, Yes, I Glow in the Dark, 1 Mile from Three Mile Island to Fukushima and Nuclear Hot Seat. That's if you'd like a more complete story on what happened to me during the accident, what it did to me, and what it led to. And one final note based upon the interview, Russia remains our primary source for the fuel used in nuclear reactors here in the U.S. There is not and never has been an embargo against it.
Activists, shout out.
A few weeks ago, there was a great expert briefing, what scientists are telling us about radiation that nuclear boosters won't. It was on Zoom and featured Mary Olson, the founder and the brains behind Gender and Radiation Impact Project, Cindy Folkers of Beyond Nuclear, and Amanda M. Nichols, PhD, from UC Santa Barbara. In case you missed it, it is well worth your time, and we have a link to it up on the website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 717. If you're on the website, just click on the picture from the webinar, the graphic, and you'll get there. The International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons has put out a call. Do you know of any bishops' conferences, or religious communities that have supported Don't Bank on the Bomb? That's the program that seeks to have major funders, major financial organizations divest from any company that makes any component parts for nuclear weapons. If you have any information at all, even if you think ICANN may have it already, please send it along to Susie Snyder, and her email address is Susie, S-U-S-I, at ICANW.org. I can't wait to see what this one leads to. And Greg Mello of the Los Alamos Study Group and his wife Trish Williams Mello have been harassed repeatedly by vandals who have removed a 3x4-foot vinyl sign in their front yard that advocates for peace. This is now the fourth time it has happened, most recently this past Sunday, March 23rd. Greg is director of the Los Alamos Study Group, said, "The free speech issue involved here needs little explanation, except to add that the perpetrator obviously does not believe in it or in democracy, to which it is foundational." He elaborated, "The cost of the U.S. war complex runs to about $7,600 per household per year. We cannot keep this up without destroying our country. The national debt is now $37 trillion and rising fast, with about $1 trillion in interest expense currently due each year. The U.S. will never recover unless the war complex is shrunk and tamed." At the end, he said, "There is something more going on here than pulling up election signs, as bad as that is. The repetitive nature of the crime, despite the strong security cameras, the obscene gesture, which is what the perpetrator did and was caught on camera doing, and the carefully planned disguise are evidence of a strong emotion. This looks a lot like hate. What comes next?" And then stated resolutely, "We will find ways to encourage nonviolent public dialogue, as we have always done. We won't let thugs win." In closing, this has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, March 25th, 2025. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email each week, we make it really easy. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com and a big yellow box will pop up. It's an opt-in box, so just put in your first name and an email address, and every week you will get one, count them, only one email from us. We don't bug you. This email will include a link to that week's show as soon as it posts and a short description of its content. By doing this, you will never miss another episode of Nuclear Hot Seat. You can also subscribe on your favorite podcast channel because we are everywhere. Now here's audience participation time. If you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send that information in an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, we really need your help. The money goes to website hosting, paying the many fees for the many services that are necessary to keep us up and running. And if there's anything left after that, it goes in the kitty for whatever the next trip is that I need to take to provide you with top-level, cutting-edge coverage of all things nuclear from a different perspective. So anything you can do, it helps. You will be making a difference, and we will really appreciate your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2025, Libby Halevi and Hardestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, website, names of any guests whose comments you use, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you that as Eric Epstein of Three Mile Island Alert just said, the Faustian bargain with nuclear is that you get electricity for a minute and radioactive waste forever. There you have it. Couldn't make it any plainer. Your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.